Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. If you look at a map of Africa and trace your finger up the east coast, you'll find the Horn of Africa. It's that bit of land that just sticks out into the Arabian Sea like a shark's tooth. There's always heavy shipping traffic going past the Horn on its way up into the Suez Canal and into the Mediterranean. The problem is that on the Horn of Africa is the nation of Somalia, a failed state. There is no real central government controlling the whole of the country anymore. That means the waters off the coast of Somalia have pirates. Real, honest-to-God, modern-day pirates. They operate out of several ports on the Somalian coast, and business for them is booming. More and more merchant vessels are hijacked every year. One day in 2008, Jay Bahadur decided to go into the lair of the pirates and find out what they were like, to see how they operated, and to uncover where all this money was going. Jay is a young Canadian journalist, and he did just that, despite the insane risk he knew he was taking going into one of the most dangerous countries in the world. Jay Bahadur's book is called Deadly Waters, The Hidden World of Somalia's Pirates. Hi, Jay.
Hello.
What were you doing at the time that was so soul-destroying that made you think, I'm going to throw in the towel and go to Somalia?
Well, I was actually writing market research reports, they're canned reports. Essentially, it consisted of taking last year's report, filling in the blanks, essentially changing a few words around, if you want to call that writing. So it had always been my plan to break into journalism by going abroad. Essentially, every foreign correspondent I spoke to for advice told me that journalism school is sort of a dead end these days if you want to make it as a foreign reporter. So I went abroad by myself, and I figured the one thing I had to offer. I had no experience or connections or portfolio. Thought the one thing I had to offer was putting my life on the line, putting my safety at risk, and then that's what I did.
So you had no journalistic training before you went in there?
Well, I'd taken a freelance course in the School of Continuing Studies at the University of Toronto, and that was actually where I first wrote the pitch for this book that once it was on paper, it kind of started growing in my imagination. But nothing you could really call formal training. No.
Well, the reason why I ask is because what you've delivered is an honest-to-God work of real journalism.
Thank you. And I was shocked that when I got there, I spent about 3 months there total, and during the course of my first trip, I encountered no other foreign journalists until the last day when I actually encountered a group of Australian cameramen from, I think it was ABC actually, Andrew Fowler and his team were flying in to do a documentary, and they actually interviewed me, and it was my first time on TV, and I was very excited. But looking back now, the scene I must have been to them. I hadn't shaved in 3 months. I hadn't changed my clothes, I think, at that point in probably a week or two. I had just stepped out of the shower, and I think at that point they just did the interview to be polite. And when I went and looked at the finished documentary a few weeks later, I, of course, was cut for Roger Middleton, who was a very clean-shaven academic in Chatham House in London. So
had it occurred to you, there you are in ragged, foul-smelling clothes with a gigantic beard. You look like a pirate? I mean, like a pirate from the cartoon idea of what a pirate is?
I look like, my father's Indian, and actually when I grow a large beard, I kind of can pass off as Syrian or a light-skinned Arab, and quite frankly, I was surprised I wasn't stopped at the airport. I looked like the kind of guy who might be blowing up a plane for sure.
I want to assure listeners I'm looking at a kind of clean-cut guy at the moment. How does a civilian like you even get into this part of Somalia anyway?
Well, my original plan was to just show up and ask for directions to the coast and hope that a pirate gang would kind of adopt me as a mascot or something like that, could take pity on me. I don't know what I was thinking.
But you didn't have a plan?
Well, that was the plan A. I mean,
are you serious? That was your plan?
Yeah. I thought, these pirates generally don't bother people on land, so I thought if I got on land, and just talk my way into their good graces, you know, ask for directions to a pirate base somewhere. In fact, I even looked on Google Earth, and I looked up Ale, which was at that time kind of the pirate central in Somalia, and someone had tagged a structure at the outskirts of town as a pirate checkpoint. And so I was imagining going through, being frisked by pirates and brought to see their leader and so on, sort of like the South Park episode that they did a year after that or so. But essentially, there was no pirate checkpoint ever. Someone had just put that in, and Ale was a very like peaceful fishing village. But to cut a long story short, what I did essentially was ended up making a journalistic partner there, a local journalist who ran the only news station in the capital of the region I was in, which is called Puntland. Both he and his father had lived in Australia for much of the last 20 years since the civil war broke out in Somalia. His father was elected president of Puntland about a week before I got there.
Yeah, now this is one of the revelations of the book, that the current president of this kind of province of Somalia, which has kind of taken over where the central government has failed, is actually an Australian guy, an Australian Somali who was working at La Trobe University.
Yeah, he was doing his PhD at La Trobe, I think, in building institutions in collapsed states. So I think his academic training suited him very well for his career and his new career in Somalia.
Paint me a picture of what it's like to arrive in Puntland, this province of Somalia. What sort of things do you see when you travel into this place?
Pretty much the hub to get into Somalia is through Dubai. And once you get to Dubai, you get shunted off to Terminal 2, which is the home of all the pariah airlines and pariah destinations in the world that flies to Afghanistan and North Korea and Somalia. And so then once you get, you go to Djibouti, which is essentially just an American naval base, is situated there, just a country just north of Somalia, where you get into this kind of 1970s Soviet propeller plane. The crews are still pretty much former Soviet pilots who I imagine just never escaped the collapse of the Cold War. I mean, these guys are sodden with drink, literally, you know, dripping with drink and sweat, banging on exposed engine parts with wrenches. And I just imagine, because Somalia and the Soviet Union used to be very close, that they really never escaped. They were just stuck in limbo when the Soviet Union collapsed and forever condemned to kind of ferry passengers to Somalia.
Flying planes and drinking themselves to death.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's terrible stories of these planes, landing gear refusing to extend. And I actually saw one of these planes that had done a nose landing at Bosaso Airport, which was one of the northern cities that I stopped in, just abandoned there on the runway. Yeah, so Puntland, where I was, is a very desert climate, unlike southern Somalia, which is very lush and very, very similar to northern Kenya, that it's very verdant. There's a lot of agriculture. The northern Somalia is basically a desert, and this is where piracy has originated.
Once you arrived in Somalia and you're walking around the street, is it easy to spot who's a pirate?
Well, yeah, pirates have a company car. I call it the pirate company car, which is the Toyota Surf. And it's kind of the baby brother of the Land Cruiser, so just a smaller Toyota 4x4. And you can pretty much be assured that anyone driving one of those cars is a pirate. You also can tell by the fact that their license plates are recently registered, so they generally have 18 or 19 on the license plate. That's sort of another pirate indicator. And, yeah, I was so frustrated the first few days I got there. I was just so eager to begin interviewing these guys. I just wanted to run up to anyone I saw in these cars. And my partners just assured me, after sort of laughing at me, that to do that would put myself out as a target, put a bullseye on myself as a potential kidnapping target. You know, I would soon start to be followed and, eventually maybe even kidnapped doing that sort of thing. So everything in Somalia was done through clan networks. Luckily, my partner and his father belonged to the same subclan as many of the early pirates. So that was my in. That's how I got to meet the pirates. And it was really through those connections that had to be done very carefully and delicately.
How do those clan networks operate?
The way clan informs how Somalis deal with each other would probably, in sort of a Western society, be considered almost racist, even though they're the same race. So much of Somalia, especially recent history, has been defined by clan-on-clan violence. And essentially, clan divisions are the main reason Somalia collapsed as a central state. So right now, like Puntland, where most of the piracy originated, is inhabited by a clan called the Darod. If you even speak the name of a Huia, which is a clan that traditionally has inhabited Mogadishu, I mean, they'll practically spit. They won't trust people from another clan. My partner was essentially the same subclan as the pirates, five levels down. And so it was like my hand was stamped. I was a guest, essentially, of their extended family, and I was received as such.
The breakdown of the Somali state, like, it doesn't really exist anymore, does it? These smaller, more authentic governments seem to have sprung up to replace the overall national government.
Right. Right now, what you have is a collection of former warlords sitting in Mogadishu that the international community has kind of given sanction to as the official federal government. But
do they run anything in Somalia at all?
Well, I mean, right now, I think they've been bogged down for the last 3 years in trying to come up with a constitution, for as if Somalia needs a constitution of all things. It really needs to stop people from shooting each other in the street right now would be a good first step. But no, the government, I mean, they call Karzai the mayor of Kabul, and I would say Sheikh Ahmed, who's the head of the transitional federal government, is pretty much the mayor of half of Mogadishu.
Is Puntland and the city towns you're in, by and large, a peaceful place?
It certainly is compared to the south. There are spates of assassination, especially in the southern cities where the clans start to bump against each other. The Puntland clans start to live side by side to southern clans. It's very dangerous, and there are multiple assassinations.
So pirates you see driving around in mid-priced Western four-wheel drive vehicles. What about the people who aren't pirates? What kind of living conditions do they have?
Well, there's really not much for young men to do, which is sort of why you see piracy being fueled by a really ready stream of volunteers. There's very little in the way of economy. The primary avenues of employment for young men are providing security, transportation, and day labor. So you see constantly these young men sitting around in the streets chewing khat, which is a local drug of choice. It's a stimulant leaf similar to coca or betel nut. The biggest event in daily life of a resident of a Puntland city is just having the cot transports come in at around noon. The whole city mobs them. The soldiers eagerly wait and take their cot as they let the transports through. The children even chase down the trucks. The goats chase down the trucks. It's very sad, but I mean, there's no obviously official unemployment statistics, but you don't see that many people employed.
I'm with Jay Bahadur at the moment, a journalist whose book is called Deadly Waters, The Hidden World of Somalia's Pirates. He spent many months in the pirate-rich provinces of Somalia, finding out what makes them tick and how they work. You were hooked up with a pirate, a very influential one called Boya. Describe this man. What does he look like?
I'm very tall myself. I'm about 6'5", and Boya had at least 2 or 3 inches on me. He was extremely menacing and extremely gaunt. In fact, my local partner refused to meet him inside because he was afraid that Boya had tuberculosis, so he looked that emaciated. I was taken, as I said, to meet him outside in an abandoned field in the desert, 15 minutes outside of the city. And this is when I just got here, and I kind of started imagining that my partners were in fact themselves pirates, and I was being taken to be kidnapped or executed or something, because it seemed strange we were meeting him in the middle of the desert. Boya, at our first meeting, he barely looked at me. As soon as I got out of the car, he turned his back, ran away. He ran down a hill and sought a little place in a clearing to talk to me. And he wouldn't even look in my direction. He just sat around grumbling that the sun was already coming down and his day was wasted. But then as I interviewed him again and again, and in fact, when I returned to Puntland some months later, I brought him a Toronto Blue Jays baseball t-shirt as sort of a gift for his help in launching my career. And after that, I was in. He wore it for 3 days straight. And after that, he would hug me and slap my back. And he introduced me then to all his former co-workers. And I was made.
You're a made guy. What was Boya before he was a pirate general, pirate admiral?
Boya was unusual in the sense that he was in his early 40s, and he was one of the few, relatively few pirates who actually had begun as fishermen. I think a lot of the media coverage of this issue is focused on the fact that Somali pirates were originally fishermen and had the whole problem had stemmed from illegal foreign fishing. But that really is a bit of an exaggeration. It's been influenced as well by what I call the pirate PR machine, the constant allusions to fishing as a justification for their actions. But Boya, in his case, it was actually a real justification. They were lobster divers in Ale, this coastal town, and really had been subjected to horrible depredations.
Yeah, so as lobster divers, they would literally just dive down into the coral and find the little hidden places where lobsters were.
Yeah, exactly. They were artisanal divers, so they would go in and with their hands find these rock lobsters that they would export to the Gulf states for about $30 a kilo. So in Somalia, that was by far Somalia's most valuable export by weight.
So why did that come to an end?
Foreign fishing, and this is, it's been documented by outside sources, the UN as well, came in and following the civil war, the outbreak of the civil war, when obviously the Somali Navy and the Coast Guard ceased to exist, a lot of these ships made contracts with local warlords who would allow them access, sometimes post guards on the decks of their ship to protect them. Not only would they destroy the reefs through drag fishing, this is where the lobsters bred, but, you know, there were stories I heard from the local people of local fishermen being swept up in nets and drowned, shot at, and their gear overrun, and so on.
The very nature of the way these foreign fishing trawlers operated meant that they destroyed many of those reefs forever, didn't they?
Yeah, well, that was the allegation. And that allegation has been backed up by UN reports. But, you know, within the Ministry of Fisheries, Puntland Ministry of Fisheries, I interviewed officials there, and they painted a picture that wasn't totally that black and white. With pretty much anything coming out of Somalia, the information is so hard to verify.
How senior was Boya as a local pirate?
Well, I was trying to figure out for the longest time what his position was. He was a legend locally. He, you know, people called him the father of piracy. Some called him the godfather. He was considered largely to be the originator of piracy in Puntland. This is something other pirates I spoke to took exception to. But all my interviews were being translated. I didn't speak Somali. And one of the things I found very hard was when I asked Boya what his title was, what his role was. It was translated to me as chief of the Coast Guard or commander of the Central Committee. These kind of terms that were very, you know, it wasn't cut and dry what it meant in English or if the ideas were being conveyed properly. And when these ideas are, or these words are what I'm trying to get is a picture of the organizational structure. You know, it was not at all clear. And what I finally came to understand after, you know, weeks and months of being there is that Boya was essentially a financier who originally started out hijacking ships himself, then sat back and took the cushy life of the money man. And essentially, as with how most Somali pirate organizations operate, they're very loose confederations of relatives and members of the same clan who come together, connected to an individual with money, come together for mission and then disperse. And Boya called himself the head of the Central Committee. And I think what the Central Committee was essentially just other financiers like him who had the purse strings.
Jay, how do they feel about the term pirate? Do they like being called pirates?
Well, that was something I had to be sort of politically careful when I was interviewing some of them, because a number of them, when I called them pirates, immediately they would rejoin, no, we're not pirates. Illegal fishing ships are the real pirates, and so on. And one term they used for themselves was Badadinta Bada, which is loosely translated as saviors of the sea. And I think this is something as well that's been translated as Coast Guard. They often call themselves Coast Guards. And so it's sort of, you have to be careful. It's sort of the difference between a freedom fighter or a terrorist. You know, it's depending on how you look at it.
Did you find them, they try and offer spontaneous acts of self-justification? How did they feel about the ethics of attacking, boarding merchant vessels in the area, taking whatever was on board or taking people hostage? How did they explain, did they want to justify themselves to you, Jay?
Well, the illegal fishing, as I said, there was a very real pirate PR machine at work, and they were very cognizant of how they were portrayed in the international media and how this illegal fishing motif is something that foreign journalists seized again and again. It was a very simple way of explaining what was going on. Foreign fishing came in and spurred this natural vigilante action. But when it got down to, well, why are you attacking foreign commercial ships then, the issue got a little trickier. And I had one pirate, Garad Muhammad, who was another one of these early godfather-type figures. He told me, when I asked him, well, then what are these commercial ships you're attacking? He just waved his hand and said, oh, you know, commercial ships and fishing ships, they have the same owners. And so it was something that obviously he hadn't thought too much about, or people hadn't questioned him about that before.
So as far as illegal fishing goes, yeah, maybe once. But what you're dealing with, by the sound of things, are just gangsters, really.
Yeah, I mean, I try to group Boya and his men in a different category than the pirates you're seeing operating now, who are very much have taken a violent turn, are employing torture and even murder sometimes.
Is Boya a killer?
No, I tracked as far as I could every hijacking that he was associated with, and there were no deaths or fatalities. And he always insisted to me that it was nothing more than a bluff. his representation of it to me was that if this bluff had been called and if they had been attacked by, say, foreign naval force, that his men just would have retreated and given up their ship.
So most of the time he's talking to you, he's presenting, "I'm just a reasonable businessman working in extraordinary circumstances" kind of pitch.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time where he or Garrard, the other pirate, sort of showed you the other side, the stone-cold gangster?
Garrard certainly tried to portray himself as almost a mafioso. They were very different men. And in fact, when I told you that some pirates took exception to Boya's primacy, and Garrard was one of them, when I spoke to him about Boya, he suddenly snapped. He says, "You know, I was the first one. It wasn't Boya." And unlike Boya, who actually, at the time when he was speaking to me, was actually going through a redemption campaign where he had sworn off piracy and was encouraging everyone else to do so for religious reasons.
Well, that's what he said.
Well, yeah, and in fact, yeah, it became clear later that he had been financing piracy the whole time, and ended up not to ruin the end of my book, but he ended up in prison where he's now serving a life sentence. Garrard, on the other hand, wasn't making any pretensions about it. You know, he told me in no uncertain terms that as long as illegal fishing ships were trawling our seas, he would keep fighting. And the quote, "the only thing he cared about was sending more pirates into the sea." Instead of Boya, who was trying to downplay his past, Garrard was glorifying himself and essentially claimed to command a pirate army of 800 men who were controlled by 13 lieutenants reporting directly to Garrard. And this would have given him credit for basically half of all of Somalia's pirates. And it was obviously a ridiculous claim. He was making quite a number of ridiculous claims, but certainly showed none of the remorse, or at least putative remorse, that Boya was showing.
Boya, how did he tell you the story of the hijack of the ship, the Golden Nori?
Well, the Golden Nori was really one of the first commercial ships to really be hijacked in the modern era of piracy. It was a full-on chemical tanker. It was owned by a Japanese company. And this was hijacked in 2007, 100 miles north of the Somali coast. So you get a sense by where it was hijacked that the problem really wasn't on people's radars. I think no ship would be even close to where that vessel was hijacked. And this was one of Boya's, this is what he was most proud of, was the Golden Nori. He essentially attacked with his men in the standard pirate attack pattern. It was a two skiff team. Essentially, there's about generally 7 to 15 pirates spread in two skiffs, so one can cover the other as one approaches the ship, essentially throws a rope ladder or an aluminum ladder onto the side of the ship, climbs up, and the other skiff can hang back to provide cover.
How do they do that? I mean, that seems like a really dangerous thing for a pirate to attempt. All you've got to do is kick the ladder off, and they're in real trouble, aren't you?
Well, the point, I mean, shipping companies tell their employees not to mess with a pirate boarding operation. Essentially, what you do if you're they're now more complicated
protocols.
Protocols, yeah, for when your ship's attacked. But essentially, the most basic thing is you increase speed, and then you essentially veer back and forth to try to create waves to disrupt the pirate skiffs. But if you go and try and kick the ladder off, I mean, that's why the second skiff is hanging back to, throw some bullets your way. And but essentially, the shipping companies are so concerned about really having an incident splash across the news or having one of their crew killed in some grisly way that it's essentially no resistance whatsoever to pirate boarding attempts.
Okay, so in the case of the Golden Nori, they succeeded. They surrounded the ship. Was this a huge ship we're talking about?
It was a chemical tanker. So, it was, like I said, this was one of the really early high-profile hijackings in the Gulf of Aden. But you can see like how unsophisticated, really, Boya and his men were at the time. I mean, they were just, like I said, it was 100 miles off Somalia, and they were just in their fishing skiffs. It wasn't like later where pirates actually started adopting much larger ships to serve as so-called motherships that enabled them to go hundreds and even over 1,000 miles into the Indian Ocean. So it was a very basic operation. Once Boya and his men had gained control of the crew, they were immediately surrounded by four U.S. warships. And this reaction struck me as odd, this intense reaction for a Japanese-flagged ship, that four U.S. warships would immediately surround the ship. And Boya could remember, actually, the call signs of the warships. And I, just to make sure he was there, I looked them up later. And it was, in fact, he still remembered the call sign of every ship that was surrounding him. And what I only realized very recently, due to a WikiLeaks cable, was that the Americans thought that this was a terrorist attack. I mean, piracy was so new, and they had hijacked a chemical tanker, and they essentially thought the pirates were going to basically ram this into Aden or the American base at Djibouti. So this is what they were worried about. And what Boya was saying is that he immediately steered the ship towards Bosaso. This was the Puntland's northern city and its most populous city. And what he thought, he was going to use the civilians as a screen. he basically thought the Americans would back off, because not only did he have this cargo, you know, he knew what it was. It was carrying benzene, highly flammable. He thought essentially that they wouldn't dare start shooting at him when he had the civilians in the backdrop. But really what it was is that they thought he was a terrorist. And once they realized he wasn't, they essentially backed off and allowed for the negotiation. So he was on there for, I think this is a very fairly short captivity period, maybe a month or a month and a half. And he got $1.5 million, which for the time was a very high amount. But even, again, to indicate how unsophisticated they were, this is, like I said, a very short captivity period. But he was already saying how they had no food, they hadn't provisioned for food. He was joking that he almost needed to eat the crew. Then once he got his money, they just let him go. And, you know, I asked him why, once he had been paid and once he was off the ship, why the Americans didn't just pick him up. He said, because, you know, they wanted to honor our agreement. When, again, I think the reason was probably now that they knew that he wasn't a terrorist, they didn't...
Lost interest.
They didn't care.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Jay Bahadur is here. Jay is a guy who decided to make his entree into journalism at the very pointy end of it. He went into pretty much the most dangerous country in the world to find out about the lives of Somali pirates. His book is called Deadly Waters, The Hidden World of Somalia's Pirates. How typically do the ransom amounts, the extortion amounts, get delivered to these pirates once they camp out on the ships that they hijack, Jay?
Well, it's virtually, with a few exceptions, that ransom payments are made. Shipping companies have insurers, generally speaking, who then are responsible very often for furnishing the ransom. So from their point of view, they just want to, they've paid the insurance premium, this is what it's for, they just want to get out without their crew being slaughtered, which would really be a much bigger issue than the 1 or 2, 3, 4 millions that they'd end up paying to release the ship, which is still, for the most part, the ransoms paid are between 2 and 5% of the value of the ship and the cargo. So really, it's cost of doing business.
Right, there's an understanding about that. It's almost like tipping a taxi driver by the sound of it.
Oh, things. Yeah, right.
It's kind of an accepted percentage, the figure that
operates. Well, the thing is that it sounds very low, right? Like I mentioned, Boya got $1.5 million, which would have been even much lower than 2%. They hadn't even realized at this point how much they were lowballing. And this is why, one of the reasons why ransoms keep going up, because pirate negotiators are becoming more experienced and realizing that they're not really near the top amounts they could be demanding.
So how is the cash delivered then? How do they actually get hold of those great big bundles of American dollars, I'm assuming is what they are?
Yeah, so what happens is the insurance company will deal with a private security firm. The money will be routed through banks in Dubai or Nairobi often, and just cash loaded from a Nairobi bank into a Cessna or other small aircraft. And a private security team will go do a couple flyovers, make sure that the entire crew is accounted for, and then parachute the money down, literally airlifted onto the decks of their ships. And the costs of legal fees, of like bank processing fees, and of hiring private security often makes the actual ransom payment close to double what the pirates are getting.
So there, Boyar's got his money for this, the Golden Nori. What, $1.2 million, I think you said?
$1.5
million. Once he's got that money and he's allowed to walk back on shore to Ale or wherever it is that he's based at the time, what does he then do with the money? Where does that money go?
Well, he claimed it had just all disappeared. And when I was interviewing him, he claimed to be penniless. This was a word that, like, the Somalis loved this word, I think, penniless. They would always go around claiming they're penniless, and especially the pirates. Boya would say, you know, he hadn't even spent the money on a house. He had no car. In fact, during our first interview, my partner Muhammad had to give him $100 just to get him some cot after the interview, just to give him some drug money. And so
You're serious? The guy's copped $1.5 million, and he's nickel and diming your translator, is he?
Well, yeah, you know, that was the cost of at least the first interview. After he kind of warmed up to me a little bit, the rest of the following interviews are all free.
But that's what he says then. But what were you able to understand was the truth of what where that 1.5 million, because he can't keep that all for himself, can he?
Well, generally speaking, these guys, especially the younger guys, are not educated. Putting money in a bank would be a totally foreign concept. It would be like giving money to someone. Like, why would I give my money to someone else? He's going to steal it, that kind of thing. And this is why, as a sort of corollary, I found it so ridiculous that a lot of early reports claim that pirates were financing business empires and pouring money into Nairobi property, when really, like, it literally all goes towards drugs or cars. They all have their friends and family networks that are, the moment they get on shore, they start draining them dry. And in fact, often when pirates get on shore, they run away and they hide somewhere. Because
everyone's got their hand out.
Yeah, exactly. And Somali culture demands that they share. It would be, you know, considered quite untoward if they tried to keep it all themselves. Just like, say, a rapper with his entourage, you know, his friends and such that haven't really made it like he has. He's expected to go around with his entourage, pay for everything. And, I mean, Boya would have been receiving probably... quite a large chunk of that 1.5, but it's quite conceivable that in, you know, the 2 years since that had happened, and that he wouldn't have had very much of it left. That being said, when he was finally arrested over a year following my meetings with him, he did have $29,000 in cash on him. So, you know, maybe he had found some pennies since I spoke to him, or I don't know.
So after everyone's put their hand out, there's still a fair bit of money left. So guys like him are spending their money then on fancy cars, such as they can get in Somalia, on cut for them to chew, and women?
Yeah, they often actually, people think of Islam as a, you know, obviously very conservative and frowning very heavily on casual sex. But one way that people get around this is with these so-called temporary marriages or traveler's marriages, where just verbally you can pronounce a marriage, go and, you know, share the rights of marriage and whatnot, and then you can verbally pronounce divorce, you know, after a week or so. And in fact, I think there's some legal quibbling over whether you can do it over text message or not. But
so then what typically happens? They get all this cash, they're spending it around the place, and then what happens when it starts to run out?
They often just ditch their wives. They often have wives and children and ditch them for a couple of weeks, go with these new women, buy them jewelry, go to hotels, turn off their phones so, you know, people can't get in touch with them. You know, once the money's gone, they go back to their old families and, you know, it's like nothing's happened. You know, maybe they'll go on another pirate mission. But it continually stunned me how often, not just in my own encounters, but just reading various other accounts people have written, just how quickly the pirates just run out of money. It's just, you know, easy come, easy go, back to, you know, back to basics. And there, you know, I just remember this one account of one pirate lord who had, in, you know, very recently had come across $4.5 million, had bought 6 Land Cruisers, discarded one after the other because they had paint chips or broken windows or things like this, literally like leaving it in the desert because it had a flat tire or whatever, that it's below their dignity to repair. And at the time that this reporter interviewed this man, he claimed not to even have $100 to invest in, which was a minimum, I guess, you need to invest in a new mission. So it's just, it was absolutely crazy how quickly it slipped out of their fingers.
Jay Bahadur is here, Canadian journalist who spent some time amongst the pirates of Somalia in the region that's called Puntland. And his book about his time with them is called Deadly Waters, The Hidden World of Somalia's Pirates. We were speaking earlier of cut, which they're all mad for, not just the pirates, everyone's mad for in that area. Explain what cut exactly is and the narcotic effect that it produces.
It's a plant that's not grown in Somalia. It's actually grown in Kenya and Ethiopia and imported every day into Somalia because it must be consumed fresh. The active chemical breaks down, I think, within 24 hours. So the funny thing is, when I say all the money goes to cut, really what they're doing when pirates get ransoms, which is really probably now maybe the second biggest foreign exchange earner for Somalis after maybe livestock export, immediately that money goes back into the international markets, either Kenya and Ethiopia in form of cut purchases, or to the Gulf states in the form of Land Cruiser and Toyota Surf 4x4 imports. It doesn't lead to any sustained rise of living on the ground. And cod itself, like I said, has to be consumed fresh.
What kind of buzz does it give its consumers?
It's very similar, I think. I've never chewed coca leaf, but essentially it just gives you heightened energy, awareness, you become more talkative, your jaw starts to clench. It's from my own experience doing it. And one of the effects that when I was being briefed from my own cod experience, people said I would either become relaxed and talkative or completely sex crazed. And so this was apparently like these two very different effects. And apparently this is another reason for these temporary marriages that a lot of the pirates, it's not just, the people who were briefing me were not the only ones who said this. I've read this everywhere that often, people who chew cod just can't be without a woman and have to.
Is it like cocaine in the sense that you might want that kind of sexual interaction, but it's once you're there, it's actually kind of hard to actually make it happen?
Well, I can't speak to that because it made me. I had the relaxed and talkative effect.
What do people but actually, tell it's, you, MJ?
It's funny because Somali women are often, well, they hate it. Obviously, they hate when their husbands blow all the money on cot. Obviously, but also there's kind of an old wives' tale. Which I'm not sure is true or not, but that it makes you impotent over time. So there's, I guess, another reason why the women don't like their husbands chewing it.
Has consumption of cat rocketed up since piracy has taken off over the last decade?
Yeah, it's very. I mean, it's very hard to find official statistics, obviously. But I interviewed some cat merchants, and one of them told me that there had been days before the days of pirate ransoms, there had been times that she wouldn't even make more than a dollar or two in a day, and now claimed that her net revenue from each day was $600. That was only one case, but it was clear that other merchants I interviewed all experienced this massive rise in their sales. One thing they also said is that the pirates always paid in cash. Before, they often just had bums mooching off them, like, drug addicts asking for credit, whining, pawning things, I guess.
So it is addictive?
It is, yeah, it's quite addictive. And yeah,
are kids consuming it?
Absolutely. I mean, the kids, when the transports come in, one of the saddest things you see is just, especially in the poorer areas of town, the kids just mob the transports. And you see them picking up these stalks that have fallen off the truck out of the dirt and, chewing them. It's a pretty sad state of affairs.
Jay, while you were there, you met with President Abdurrahman Farole, as we mentioned before, a man who spent 20 years living in Australia, waiting out the end of the Somali Civil War, who's now become president of this regional government there. He was elected promising to institute a powerful coast guard, a real coast guard, which would patrol the waters for pirates. How's he doing?
Well, I don't think he made any specific promise about a coast guard in his campaign, but he did promise to crack down very harshly on piracy. Actually, there was an effort a couple months ago, probably 5-6 months ago now, to bring in a private security firm called Saracen to train 1,000-strong coast guard, provide marine patrol aircraft, and also just armored transports to get them around.
Why does he want to do that? Given that if he successfully stamps out piracy, if he's sitting there in his office, he's going to look at, if I stamp out piracy, that's a real genuine now source of income for all these coastal communities in my area now. And when you stop the piracy, then you stop the income. All these people who are addicted to cart are not going to be able to afford the cart anymore. It'll lead to a collapse of that kind of very fragile economy such as it is. So why is he... In all honesty, do you think he's opposed to piracy?
Yeah, well, one, I think, is that the economic benefits of piracy to Puntland are negligible. Like I said, most of the money, I think, actually just goes right back into international markets, does not go to develop local communities. The local people actually universally hate the pirates, and one of the reasons is they actually drive up prices for food and water and fuel and things in their towns. So they basically cause massive inflation. And
so he sees piracy then as an impediment to a real economy.
Well, I guess, yeah, you could say that. And also, I mean, he sees it as an impediment really to getting foreign aid, for sure. I think it's been his mission to kind of reestablish international ties. The Puntland government more or less collapsed from 2007 to 2009 and had completely lost its ability to function either internally and externally was viewed as completely ineffectual. And what Frehley's main agenda was to re-engage with international actors. And really, that international aid pipeline would be a lot more lucrative and also a lot more beneficial than, you know, what benefits trickle down from piracy.
Why have the various attempts at setting up a kind of Coast Guard force ended up doing more harm than good?
A lot of the early attempts, this I mentioned the latest project, Saracen International, which was Frehley's project to set up an anti-piracy marine force. That was squashed by the United Nations, actually, and a lot of pressure by international journalists because they said it was violating UN arms embargoes since Puntland is not officially recognized as an actor. But earlier Coast Guard attempts, there had been a number of other attempts to set up Coast Guards in Puntland from 1999, and these were also private security firms brought in. But what happened, especially with one company called the Somali Canadian Coast Guard, which was run by actually a former Somali cab driver from my hometown, Toronto, and they set up this Coast Guard task force with three vessels and along with some speedboats, which is already ridiculously impossible task to patrol 1,600 kilometers with three boats. But what they ended up doing is protecting foreign fishing. They had their own clients. They had specifically a Thai company called Sirachai, which, you know, bought them their uniforms and was very closely connected to the Coast Guard. And they would post guards on the decks of those ships, and often they would come into conflict with local fishermen. The Coast Guards, specifically this Coast Guard, may have actually done its bit to accelerate the rise of piracy just due to continuing to aggrieve these local fishermen who lashed out.
Coast Guards become pirates too, don't they? And then pirates become Coast Guards, become fishermen, become Coast Guards, become pirates, become fishermen.
Yeah, there's a revolving door for sure.
This is why people throw their hands up at places like Africa, because everything that is attempted there ends up seemingly counterproductive. Maybe that's because of the clumsiness of any kind of intervention, but it's kind of hard, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, to go down in the anthology of unintended consequences, these Coast Guard experiments, as I said, they may have done their bit. It's hard to really prove this conclusively, but they may have definitely done their bit to accentuate piracy. And then after they dissolved and their contracts were up and so on, there is much more compelling evidence to suggest that these former Marines became pirates. I mean, you were unemployed and you had skills such you were trained in marksmanship and you're trained in boarding and seizure operations. Well, there's very clear application of those skills in maritime piracy.
So essentially, the Coast Guard would take unemployed people, train them in marksmanship, seamanship, boarding vessels, and GPS, which have ended up really essentially having better trained, more highly proficient pirates.
Yeah, especially in the early days, we're talking 2007, 2008. There's definite evidence that the people out there were the new professional wave of pirates that really launched this modern era of Somali piracy were former Coast Guards. Especially when you have, these kind of unaccountable private security projects that are going up, you have to realize that sometimes there are really consequences that are unforeseen.
Tell me about the pirate attack on merchant vessel, the MV Maersk Alabama.
Well, that was the first American ship hijacked by pirates in 200 years. And this is really, well, it sold my book for one. This incident became international news and catapulted Somali piracy into the front pages. There were only four pirates, first of all, which was an unusually low number, and it came back to really bite them because as two pirates secured the bridge with the captain and a seaman, the others went to find the rest of the crew, and because there were only two or three of them searching, they were actually overpowered, and one of them was taken hostage. And in a bungled attempt to do a hostage exchange with the still captive captain, the pirates escaped, took the captain, and this ended in a Hollywood-style shootout. Three of the pirates remaining on the ship were shot and killed by Navy SEAL snipers. They actually are making a Hollywood movie out of that, so starring Tom Hanks.
Is there any kind of moral code that the pirates operate by?
The only evidence I know of external moral code was a manual that was captured early on. I think it was captured from a group that had hijacked a French yacht in, would have been 2008 probably. And what this code said was they had rules for not abusing the hostages. One of the definite rules was don't sexually abuse any women. And I think this was more of a pragmatic code than probably a moral code because they were worried that abusing hostages would jeopardize their position and their standing with the shipping companies. now, unfortunately, what you see is the violence is escalating, and they're now using tactics like mock executions, beatings. In some cases, they've even thrown hostages in freezers. These are now being used to pressure shipping companies. So I think the breed of pirate you have out there right now is a lot more bloodthirsty and willing to use violence. And they're also doing things like now making videos of hostages and releasing them to the international media. So they're becoming more savvy like this. It hasn't got to the level where they're sending fingers, but it's conceivable that it could move in that direction.
There's some maps at the start of your book, Jay, of the Horn of Africa, and you've got little dots there that look like little fly specks for pirate incidents, hijacking incidents off the coast of Somalia. 2007, there's a couple of dots. There's about quite a few for 2008, even more for 2009. And 2010, those dots are nearly on the coast of India there.
Yeah.
It seems to be a problem that's getting worse. After spending that time there, what can be done to actually clamp down on piracy? Is there a call for a kind of a permanent NATO presence, warships in that area?
Well, there is pretty much a permanent NATO presence there. I mean, there's been a presence of NATO, the European Union, and an American organized task force since 2008, isn't it? Late 2008. And those ships aren't going anywhere. Their mandates to keep getting extended. The number of ships are varying from about 25 to 40, I think. Unfortunately, it hasn't been too effective, because what you did see very early on is that the European Union came in, were very successful at clamping down on the Gulf of Aden. They created a safety transit corridor where they patrolled and allowed for convoys and escorts and so on. And that immediately cut down piracy in the Gulf of Aden. But as I sort of alluded to earlier, you had pirates who then started using these motherships, floating bases, towing their skiffs that would allow them to go hundreds of miles into the Indian Ocean, and as you pointed out, much closer to India than Africa. And so once you get out there, pirate attacks now have occurred in an area the size of about 80% of the size of the United States.
What about the Indian Navy then, such as it is? Is the Indian Navy taking an interest?
The Indian Navy has ships patrolling Somalia. In fact, we're responsible for one of the more bloodthirsty incidences of the history of Somali piracy, where the Indian Navy actually mistakenly blew up a Thai fishing ship and killed 15 people. Those deaths are all attributed to pirates, actually. So the Indian Navy is very active, but if you're going to effect a rescue of a ship that's under attack by pirates, you really have to be within 70, 80 kilometers maximum and be equipped with a naval helicopter, which many of these ships aren't. So you really have very few ships that are within range of effecting rescues. And within the Indian Ocean, I mean, most of the ships that are actively rescued by the patrolling naval ships are in the Gulf of Aden. When you get into the Indian Ocean, it's extremely rare that the naval forces have anything to do with the rescue. It's more to do with a ship maybe engaging in evasive maneuvers or increasing speed, spotting the pirates in time. That's the most important thing.
Jay, how about you? Now that you've left that part of Somalia, are you keen to go back, or are you glad you've gotten the hell out of that place and never want to return?
Well, I think it might be a lot more dangerous for me to go back now. I don't...
It's not really what I'm asking, though.
Oh.
did you like it, is what I'm saying, really?
I did. I mean, it was really a time where everything was new for me. I was learning my job as I went along. There were a lot of challenges, but each day kind of brought a new thing. It was very stressful at times, too, because my partners were very, very worried about me getting kidnapped and putting a black mark on the new president's reputation. So a lot of the time I was basically held under guard and would spend a lot of days just sitting in a compound, not doing much. I had all my energy focused on this. I spent a total of 2 years of my life working on this book, and yeah, it was the beginning of my career, and a career that I intend to stick with. So,
have you had cuts since then?
I've not, although you can get it on the streets of Toronto. Only, like I said, it has to be consumed the same day. So by the time it gets out there, it's pretty much withered and dry and about three times as expensive. So I don't think I'd be purchasing it anytime soon.
Jay, thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
Thank you very much.
Jay Bahadur's book is called Deadly Waters, The Hidden World of Somalia's Pirates.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.